all, I will be back again next week. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in Music and supporting us and our musicians. Indigenous in Music has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Say Magazine Studios in Sarasota, Florida. Indigenous in Music is distributed by Native Voice One, PRX, and Pacifica Audio Port. And you can always come visit us and see all of our past shows on our music page at indigenousinmusic.com. Have yourself a good evening and a good night. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in Music, adios. Oh, yeah.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
For 50 years, the Banree Foundation has supported the continuing education of women at Queen's. Join Banree for its 50th anniversary gala on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. This event marks half a century of empowering women through education. Tickets are free, but registration is required. To reserve your spot, visit the Banree Center's website, follow Banree Center on Facebook and Instagram, or email brc@queensu.ca.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I saw Aisha Noor lying on the ground beneath an olive tree, literally bleeding to her death. There was blood gushing from her head. I kneeled and I put my hand behind her back to try and stop the bleeding.
Turkish-American citizen Aisha Noor Ezgi-Aygi is shot in the head and killed by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank as she took part in a solidarity protest against illegal Israeli settlements. The U.S. response? Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We deplore this tragic loss. Now, the most important thing to do is to gather the facts, and that's exactly what we're in the process of doing. And we are intensely focused on getting those facts. And any actions that we take are driven by the facts.
Aisha Noor's family is calling for an independent investigation. We'll hear an eyewitness account from Israeli activist Jonathan Pollack, who held Aisha Noor as she lay dying. And we'll speak with another U.S. citizen who was shot in the leg last month as he took part in the same weekly protests in the West Bank. We'll also speak with a friend of Aisha Noor Aygi from the University of Washington, where she just graduated. And we'll be joined by the parents of Rachel Corey, the American student who was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza as she tried to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. And as Israeli forces reinvade areas of the West Bank following a massive operation there last week, we'll speak with Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti. Her article for 972 magazine, Inside the Brutal Siege of Jenin. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's war on Gaza has entered its 12th month as the official death toll nears 41,000, though that's believed to be a vast undercount. Israel killed at least 8 Palestinians Saturday in an airstrike on a school housing displaced people in the Jabalia refugee camp. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Michael Fakhry, has accused Israel of carrying out a starvation campaign in Gaza. The World Food Program warns some 2.2 million Palestinians in Gaza remain in urgent need of food and humanitarian aid. In the occupied West Bank, a funeral is being held today for the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, who was shot dead Friday by Israeli forces. She was a 26-year-old recent graduate of the University of Washington who was volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement. She was shot while taking part in a weekly protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beita. The Israeli activist Jonathan Pollack witnessed the shooting.
By the time this had happened, it was completely quiet here. We were standing for 10, 15 minutes without anything happening. The reason why no one was filming is because it was completely quiet. And then all of a sudden, two shots. And the sniper or the soldier that was there took a kill shot.
Jonathan Pollack held Ayşenur as she lay dying. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Meanwhile, Israeli troops are also accused of fatally shooting a 13-year-old Palestinian girl named Bana Laboum. She was hit by a bullet while inside her own home in the village of Karyut, which had been attacked by Israeli settlers. Bana's mom spoke out after her daughter was killed.
She was in her room along with her sisters. She was afraid, in fear, and suddenly a bullet got in through the window and hit her while she was on her bed. This is what happened. There were scuffles outside with the youth, but we were surprised that a bullet came through the window and onto her.
As many as 750,000 Israelis took to the streets Saturday in Tel Aviv and other cities calling for a Gaza ceasefire and hostage deal in what's been described as one of the largest protests in Israeli history. This is Zahiro Shachar Moore, whose uncle, Abraham Mander, died in captivity in Gaza.
As long as Netanyahu remains in power, we will keep getting hostages back in body bags. Netanyahu must be removed from power in order to save the lives of the hostages and the country itself.
A Jordanian truck driver shot dead 3 Israeli security guards at a border crossing between the occupied West Bank and Jordan Sunday. Israel responded by temporarily closing all border crossings with Jordan. Pedestrian traffic has resumed on the Allenby Bridge, the site of the shooting. 3 Lebanese paramedics were killed and 2 were injured Saturday in an Israeli attack on southern Lebanon. The Lebanese government said the paramedics were killed as they were responding to fire sparked by recent Israeli airstrikes. In related news, Israel's accused of attacking Syria overnight, killing at least 16 people in Hama province. Another 36 people were wounded. Donald Trump's sentencing in his hush money election interference case has been pushed back till November 26, weeks after the presidential election. New York Judge Juan Merchan made the ruling on Friday. On the same day, Trump appeared in a different New York courtroom as his lawyers attempted to overturn his sexual abuse conviction in the E. Jean Carroll case. Trump later held a news conference where he assailed Carroll and another woman, Jessica Leeds, who'd accused him of sexual misconduct on a plane.
It couldn't have happened. It didn't happen. And she would not have been the chosen one. She would not have been the chosen one.
To see our interviews with Jessica Leeds, you can go to democracynow.org. On Saturday, Donald Trump also posted a message on social media threatening to jail opponents if he wins re-election. He wrote, quote, "When I win, those people that cheated will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, which will include long-term prison sentences so that the depravity of justice does not happen again. Please beware that this legal exposure disclosure extends to lawyers, political operatives, donors, illegal voters, and corrupt election officials, Trump wrote. This all comes as Trump prepares for Tuesday's debate against Kamala Harris. Sudan's warring parties rejected a call by UN experts to deploy an international force to protect civilians from the devastating civil war which erupted last April. A UN fact-finding mission reported harrowing human rights abuses committed by both Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. The World Health Organization's Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus visited Port Sudan over the weekend.
According to available data, Sudan's conflict has so far killed more than 20,000 people. This is an underestimate, by the way. Displaced over 10 million people inside the country and forced another 2 million to flee to neighboring countries. This is the largest internal displacement of people in the world today. The scale of the emergency is shocking, and as is the insufficient action being taken to curtail the conflict and respond to the suffering it's causing.
This comes as new video has emerged from Sudan showing the aftermath of an ethnically motivated massacre by RSF fighters in Darfur's Kassab camp in the town of Khotum last year. The attack killed an estimated 73 people. The RSF have been accused of many other deadly attacks on Black Sudanese communities. In France, tens of thousands of people took to the streets Saturday to protest President Emmanuel Macron's appointment of conservative Michel Barnier as the new prime minister. Leftist parties, which won the most votes in July's snap parliamentary elections, accused Macron of stealing the election. This is Benjamin Lucas, a deputy from the leftist New Popular Front coalition.
By appointing Michel Barnier, the president of the French Republic has decided to spit in the face of the millions of French people who turned out on July 7th to vote in a historic election. The question before us was whether or not we wanted the extreme right to win in this country. The French said no. There was a massive turnout, the highest since 1981. The message was clear. We don't want the extreme right in power.
Venezuela's former opposition presidential candidate Mundo Gonzalez has fled to Spain to seek asylum after spending weeks in hiding. Gonzalez was facing arrest in Venezuela after he accused President Nicolas Maduro of stealing the July election. Venezuela's Supreme Court certified Maduro's victory, but many countries, including the United States, have claimed Gonzalez won. Pope Francis has arrived in East Timor, becoming the first pope to visit the largely Catholic country since it gained independence in 2002. More than half of East Timor's population of 1.3 million people are expected to attend an open-air mass on Tuesday. The Timorese government has faced backlash for spending $12 million on the papal visit and for bulldozing the homes of many poor families ahead of the pope's visit. A group of Timorese groups have called on Pope Francis to address the history of sexual abuse by priests in Timor-Leste. In Vietnam, at least 59 people were killed as Typhoon Yagi triggered massive floods and landslides. A major bridge collapsed and a bus was seen being swept away in floodwaters earlier today. This is a resident of the port city of Haiphong.
The damage done to this community is extremely severe. Most of the roof was blown away or the ceiling caved in. It may take 3 or 4 years for this place to look the same again because the damage is so terrible. The surroundings look like an apocalypse day. Never before has a storm dealt this much damage to us.
Typhoon Yagi killed at least 20 people in the Philippines and 4 in southern China last week. Climate change is making extreme weather events like typhoons more frequent and deadlier. Boeing has reached a tentative deal with over 30,000 workers in the Pacific Northwest ahead of a possible strike Friday. The deal includes a 25% pay raise, better retirement and health benefits, pledging to build its next commercial aircraft in the Seattle area and giving the union more say in safety and quality issues. And Miami police have launched an investigation after officers stopped and detained Miami Dolphins star Tariq Hill as he drove to Sunday's game. An officer handcuffed and placed Hill face down on the street just outside the football team's stadium. Police also handcuffed Hill's teammate, Calais Campbell, who said he was trying to de-escalate the situation. Both men are black. After the players were released, Hill scored a touchdown to help the Dolphins win. During the touchdown celebration, a teammate pretended to handcuff Tariq Hill in the end zone. Tariq Hill spoke to reporters after the game.
I still don't know what happened. You know what I'm saying? But I do want to say, I do want to be able to use this platform to say, like, what if I wasn't Tariq Hill, bro? Like, worst case scenario, you know, because it's crazy.
One Miami police officer involved in the incident has been placed on administrative leave. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we return, Turkish-American citizen Aysenur Ezgiagi is shot in the head and killed by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank as she took part in a solidarity protest against illegal Israeli settlements. Stay with us. As I Have by Daughters of Jerusalem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Nablus, in the occupied West Bank, a funeral procession is underway at the time of this broadcast for the Turkish-American activist Aysenur Ezgiagi. She was killed by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank on Friday. Aysenur was a 26-year-old recent graduate of UW, the University of Washington in Seattle. She was shot dead by Israeli forces during a weekly Friday protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beitia. According to eyewitnesses, Israeli soldiers fired tear gas and live ammunition, forcing the protesters to disperse down a hill on the edge of the town. Israeli activist Jonathan Pollack, who was on the scene, said the shooting took place about half an hour after the protesters had dispersed and the situation was calm. He said Aysenur and other foreign volunteers were standing about 200 yards from the Israeli military. He described what happened.
So after retreating from the hilltop, I was right there where the garbage can is, and it was completely quiet already back then. The clashes had dissipated, and then after 10 or 15 minutes, it was completely quiet. I heard two distinct shots of live ammunition. One hit a metal object, and then I retreated a little bit backwards into the olive grove, and then a few seconds after, maybe 2 or 3 seconds, a second shot, and I heard someone calling my name and saying in English, help, help us, we need help, come over. So I raced through the olive groves down there. Her head was gushing with blood. She was lying here. I
I put my hand behind her back to try and stop the bleeding, which didn't stop. I looked up and saw a direct line of sight from where the soldiers were on the that rooftop, some 200 meters away. I quickly took her pulse. It was very, very weak. Her eyes were rolled back. Her skin started becoming yellow. And we panically called for the ambulance to come. By the time this had happened, it was completely quiet here. We were standing for 10, 15 minutes without anything happening. The reason why no one was filming is because it was completely quiet. And then all of a sudden, two shots. And the sniper or the soldier that was there took a kill shot. And this happens in context. This isn't an isolated incident. It happens in the context of the 17 people who were killed in demonstrations in Beta since 2021. We have heard nothing about them because they're not Americans.
That was Israeli activist Jonathan Pollack. Aishanur was taken to a hospital in Nablus, where she was pronounced dead on arrival. The governor of Nablus told reporters Saturday an autopsy confirmed that Aishanur was, quote, killed by an Israeli occupation sniper's bullet to the head, unquote. The Israeli military said in a statement it was, quote, looking into reports that a foreign national was killed and that, quote, details of the incident and the circumstances in which she was hit are under review, unquote. The statement added Israeli forces had, quote, responded with fire toward a main instigator of violent activity who hurled rocks at the forces and posed a threat to them, unquote. The Turkish government has said it holds Israel as responsible for Aishanur's death. On Saturday, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, blasted Israel for the killing.
Gencecik bir evladımızı Aishanur Ezgi Eygi.
Yesterday they heinously murdered our young child, Aishanur Ezgi Eygi. To date, they have killed over 40,000 innocent civilians, including 17,000 children. They attack barbarically and shed blood indiscriminately, whether it be children, women, youth, or the elderly.
Meanwhile, the White House has called on Israel to investigate the attack. This is Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking on Friday.
First, I just want to extend my deepest condolences, the deepest condolences of the United States government, to the family of Aishanur Ezgi Yaga. We deplore this tragic loss. Now, the most important thing to do is to gather the facts, and that's exactly what we're in the process of doing. And we are intensely focused on getting those facts. And any actions that we take are driven by the facts. So first things first, let's find out exactly what happened, and we will draw the necessary conclusions and consequences from that.
Aishanur's family has called for an independent investigation, saying, quote, we welcome the White House's statement of condolences, but given the circumstances of Aishanur's killing, an Israeli investigation is not adequate. We call on President Biden, Vice President Harris, and Secretary of State Blinken to order an independent investigation into the unlawful killing of a U.S. citizen and to ensure full accountability for the guilty parties, end quote. At least 17 Palestinian protesters have been killed in Beita in protests against illegal Israeli settlements since 2020. For more, we're joined by two guests, Amado Sison, which is a pseudonym, is a Filipino-American citizen who was shot in the leg by the Israeli forces 1 month ago today, on August 9th, during the weekly protests in Beita in the occupied West Bank. Sison was volunteering with the International Nonviolent Protective Presence Group, FAZA, the same group Aishanur was with, along with being a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement. Amado Sison is a high school English teacher from Jersey City in New Jersey. We're also joined by Juliet Majid, She was friends with Aishanord at the University of Washington. Juliet Majid is now a PhD student at North Carolina State University. She's joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Juliet, let's begin with you. Tell us who Aishanord is. She, like you, just graduated from UW, from the University of Washington in Seattle, where she grew up since, well, her family came there from Turkey since before she was 1 year old.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for saying who she is. She's no longer with us, but her spirit and her love and who she was and who she impacted in our community are still with us every single day. The family, I think, in their statement had beautiful, beautiful words that I want to uplift on who she was. She was amazing, a staunch advocate and organizer. She was passionate about justice. She was compassionate and kind, and she wore her heart on her sleeves. She always made you feel like you were listened to. You never had to think when talking to her. You just had to be. That's how she was. She just was herself, nobody else. She inspired everybody she ever met. She inspired me, and I know that going forward, I will keep holding her in my heart as well.
Juliet, I know this is incredibly difficult to you, for you. She was killed on Friday. This is just Monday. And our deepest condolences to you and to Aishanord's family, which I know extends beyond her own family, but to the whole community at UW. Those who were involved, like you and her, in the encampment there, like there were encampments all over the United States protesting the Israeli war on Gaza. Can you talk about her activism? You talked about how she inspired you, and also about learning of her death on Friday. She had just gotten to the occupied West Bank, right? Did a training on Wednesday and was killed on Friday. And you're now a student in North Carolina.
Yeah. So I met Aishanord at the University of Washington. We both graduated in June. More than just the student encampment, she was a community organizer in Seattle. She was always volunteering to help, always volunteering in the community, in the campus, before the encampment and after. So many people met her during the encampment. She was just always around, always willing to help. She moved in a wonderful grassroots way that was just always willing to assist wherever it was needed. She never asked much of herself. She always asked what others wanted from her, what they needed from her, how she could help, what she could do. She was very passionate about the student movement at UW. She was very involved on campus. And the community is absolutely reeling, heartbroken, trying to come to terms with what happened. It was, as you said, so recent on Friday. So many, I think, community members learned through the media on Friday morning. An absolutely heartbreaking way to find out for those who loved her. And there are so many. Yeah.
This is the second loss in the UW community, because on October 7th, Chaim Katzman was killed when Hamas raided, came over from Gaza. We spoke to his sibling, Noy, who also immediately called for peace and said that their brother, Chaim, was a peace activist as well.
I can only speak to who I knew, and that was Aisha Noor, who was upholding a long tradition of international observers in the West Bank, who was deliberately killed while she was peacefully observing. I want to uplift what the family has asked for, which is a independent U.S. investigation. I don't want to just rely on the Israeli military to investigate themselves. An American citizen, a member of our community, an American human rights activist who was passionate about the liberation of all peoples here in the States and abroad, was taken from us. We want an investigation. I want our government to investigate this and to hold the guilty parties accountable.
Juliet, yeah. We're joined here in New York by another activist who joined those protests in Beita, just as Aisha Noor did last week. Amado Sison, not his real name, a pseudonym, is a Filipino-American, a Jersey City teacher, who was shot in the leg by Israeli soldiers a month ago today, August 9th, during that protest in Beita, volunteering with the international nonviolent group FAZA, if you could explain what that is, Amado, yeah. And also working with the International Solidarity Movement. In a moment, we're going to talk with Rachel Corey's parents, who was killed 20 years ago, also with the ISM, protesting the Israeli occupation. If you can talk about what happened a month ago, the fact that you too were shot, and what the U.S. government has done about this.
Yeah. So, to clarify, so ISM and FAZA, we both worked together in training. We're two separate organizations, and Aisha Noor was part of ISM, and I was part of FAZA. But we see each other during those protests.
You're walking with a cane now.
Yeah, I'm walking with a cane. They shot me in the leg.
Why were you protesting in Beita? Explain what it is.
So every week, our organizations come to Beita to protest the illegal settlement that was built upon Beita's land, the Avatar settlement, I believe. And there's a Juma prayer that happens. And after the prayer, that's when the chanting starts. We never got to get to the settlement for them to return to the land because tear gas happened. So they shoot tear gas at us. They shot live rounds at us. We've had to hide behind concrete walls. You could see the dust coming off of the concrete wall. When the live rounds hit, when they come down, we run. And then on that day, we regrouped, and then we were at the foot of the street that goes up to where the watchtower was, where the Israeli army was. We saw them coming down, and we saw Palestinians running from our left, so we ran through the olive groves. So when I was running, I got shot in the back of my leg, and I thought it was a tear gas canister because it felt like a blunt object hit me. But
we're actually showing for a TV audience your leg when you were shot.
Yeah, I only saw that twice. So when I got to the clearing, the Palestinians raised me up, put me in a pickup truck, got me to the clinic. Transferred me to ambulance and get into the hospital. We had two trucks blocking us and then two checkpoints where they demanded to see who was inside. So it delayed my care further. But the Palestinians showed me so much care and love, and I'm indebted to them for saving me that day.
I wanted to go to Jonathan Pollack, the Israeli activist who held Aisha Noor as she died. Has taken part in the weekly protests against the settlements in Beita for months. Jonathan couldn't join us today because he's taking part in this funeral procession for Aisha Noor in Nablus. We spoke to him yesterday, and this is some of what he had to say.
I would just like to say that her death is not an isolated incident. The bullet that was shot at Aisha Noor is the exact same bullet that was shot at Amadou Sisson a few weeks ago, hitting him in the leg. Another American citizen hurt in exactly the same place. It is the same bullet used by Israeli forces to kill the people in Nur al-Shams and in Jenin. And these are the same bullets that killed a 13-year-old girl on the same day that Aisha Noor was killed, just a few kilometers to the south. These are the same bullets that Israel uses to perpetrate the genocide in Gaza with complete impunity. And all these bullets are provided to Israel by the American taxpayers' money. And the one thing that set this incident apart is that on Friday, American bullets killed an American citizen. And this is why we hear of it now. But it is really time for this to stop. It is time that Israel is held accountable and is forced to end its colonial regime over Palestinians and ensure Palestinian liberation. Now, that kill shot, and this soldier took a kill shot, was meant to convey a message. And that message is that any sort of Palestinian resistance to Israeli colonialism will not be tolerated. Whether it be Palestinians resisting Israeli occupation or solidarity activists standing with Palestinians as they fight for liberation. And however violent the Israeli message is going to be, our message to the Israelis is that no matter what, we will continue to stand with Palestinians in the struggle for liberation.
So that's the Israeli activist, Jonathan Pollack, who held Ayn Shura as she died, Ayn Shanur as she died. She was there then. He went in the ambulance with her to the hospital in Nablus. He described to us also how this was after the weekly protests that they hold, this weekly protest every Friday. And they were done. It was very calm when Aisha Noor was shot in the head. Amadou Sisson, just staying with you for a moment, you were shot a month ago. What did the, you're a U.S. citizen, you're a teacher in Jersey City. What did the U.S. government do? Did you speak to the U.S. embassy?
Yes. So it was just the U.S. embassy. They reached out when I got
in Israel.
Shot. Yeah. And we filed a report. Don't have any updates about what that turned into. I did give them a report as well, consent. But no State Department, no politicians, nobody has reached out to me. And what I think is if they took it seriously that a U.S. citizen was shot a month ago, maybe Aisha Noor would be here right now.
The ambassador or staff come to you in the hospital? Did the State Department here speak to you when you returned shot in the leg?
No, nothing. I heard nothing from them.
You've demanded an investigation?
I demand an investigation now for when I was shot, for Aisha Noor's murder, an independent U.S. investigation, because what the Israeli report was it was a mistake shooting me. Mistakes usually come from above and down. They shot me through my right thigh, all the way through.
Well, they said they shot in the air.
They said it was a mistake, So I don't know what a mistake would be when you're pointing and shooting straight through someone's thigh. So I don't know what they're going to conclude about Aishanur, but I know that if they investigate themselves, they will find a way to cover it up. So I want to uplift her family's demands as well.
I want to turn right now to a family that knows the pain of a daughter's death. Aishanur Aigi had been volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, to try to protect Palestinians from attacks by the Israeli military and settlers. That's the same group that Rachel Corey, also a U.S. citizen, she was a student at Evergreen College in Washington, in Olympia. She was volunteering with ISM in 2003. When she was crushed to death, it was actually 3 days before the U.S. invaded Iraq. It was March 16, 2003. She was crushed to death in Gaza by an Israeli military bulldozer. She was trying to protect the home of a Palestinian pharmacist family in Rafah that was about to be demolished. She was 23. We're joined right now by Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey. After Rachel was killed, they devoted their lives to our cause, founded the nonprofit Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. Cindy is the foundation's president, Craig the treasurer. They've also gone on interfaith peace missions to Israel, to Gaza, and the West Bank. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Cindy and Craig. I remember seeing you at Evergreen College. It was the largest graduation Evergreen ever had in Olympia that year, 2003, but it was missing one student who was supposed to have graduated, your daughter, Cindy, who was killed in Rafah. When you heard this news of Aishanur on Friday, I was wondering your response and if you can talk about what you see as the parallels.
Thank you, Amy. And thank you to all of your guests who have shared this very tragic story. We started to get word about what had happened to Aishanur on Friday morning. And it was, of course, very disturbing and emotional for us. I think for me, it thrusts us back to that moment on March 16th, 2003, about noon, when we were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and got the word about Rachel. And I remember, just the horror and the pain of that news. And so for me on Friday morning, I remember wondering, would I ever feel whole again? Would I ever be the same person again? Could I ever enjoy life? I mean, it's a parent's nightmare. And so Friday morning, knowing that there was another family so nearby in Seattle who was getting that same kind of news was just very, very disturbing. And we continue to just feel deeply about what that family is experiencing right now.
Craig, if you can tell us, I mean, we actually just recently spoke to the two of you. You also called for an investigation. What ultimately came of the death of Rachel Corey, killed by an Israeli military bulldozer, which was a Caterpillar bulldozer?
Well, of course, we did call for a U.S. investigation in Rachel's killing. Let me say that what we're hearing today, it's upsetting to our family to hear our State Department again. And I would expect them to say that they are trying to find out the facts and looking to Israel for that. Israel does not do investigations. They do cover-ups. So let's face it, nothing's going to come out of there that's going to help these citizens or whoever may be killed in the future. That's what we're trying to stop. Our family worked for an investigation into Rachel's killing, and we wanted some consequences out of that. And we hoped, even though we didn't know the names of the people that would be killed in the future, we hoped that that would stop. and it would not happen. I think at this point, yes, U.S. has to do an investigation, but there needs to be consequences. As Jonathan pointed out, these are American weapons that are being used. That's against U.S. law, and it should be stopped. I know from working with members of Congress and their staff, working with the State Department, that under the Leahy law, usually they're asking for proof that it was a U.S. weapon. If I write a check, I don't need proof about what's going wrong. I need people to cooperate and determine that it's not our money that's being used that way. Israel does not do that, to my knowledge. So we also need to look for international help here. I think that the UN, the International Criminal Court, there are places that need to get involved. But we're just sick and tired of hearing platitudes from the State Department. And these are people we've met. We have met with Anthony Blinken before he became Secretary of State. He's a decent person. But there needs to be consequences, and there needs to be consequences that are enforced by the entire U.S. government and the international community.
We heard those words that we hear so often when something like this happens, that the U.S. had asked for a thorough, credible, transparent investigation. We did pursue help from the State Department, from our government, and we kept pursuing that help for many years. We were still getting statements in 2008 from the State Department. Michelle Bernier-Toth wrote to us about how many people in the administration at that time had spoken to their counterparts in Israel about a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation for Rachel's case. And these were people like Secretary of State Colin Powell talking to his counterpart, a long list of names that you would recognize. And at the close, she said, those requests go unanswered or ignored. And when you think about what we're doing, what we're supplying to the Israeli military, to the Israeli government, the kind of backing that's being given to them, it was just really shocking there would be this verbal request for accountability, or at least for investigation on the part of Israel. But the U.S. acknowledged that hadn't happened. And in fact, now Secretary of State Tony Blinken in 2010 confirmed for us that the position of the U.S. government in Rachel's case remains that there has not been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation in her case. Also, the U.S., we fought for investigation for years, U.S. investigation. We were told there's very limited statute that allows for that to happen in the U.S. The Justice Department and FBI apparently ultimately looked for that possibility, but we were told that policy impacts whether they take that on, and that even if there were investigation, prosecution of someone would be extremely unlikely through the U.S. So it's one of the reasons that we are saying there needs to be an international element here, an international commitment to ensuring that an unbiased investigation happens, that an impartial investigation happens. We ultimately went to the Israeli courts, which we learned are also implicated in furthering Israeli policy and occupation. And we heard the lead investigator who completed the military investigation. And it's important for people to understand Israel's investigations are military investigations. It became clear that was conducted in order to exonerate the Israeli military, not to find truth and what really happened. And that's what our family was pursuing. But the lead investigator stated under oath in Haifa court that he believed that they were at war with everyone, including the peace activists from the International Solidarity Movement. I think that's really important information for people to understand now as we move forward in this tragic case.
I want to end with the words of Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington, who's head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the largest caucus in Congress, on the killing of the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi. She said, "I'm very troubled by the reports she was killed by Israeli Defense Forces soldiers. The Netanyahu government has done nothing to stop settlement expansion and settler violence in the West Bank, often encouraged by right-wing ministers of the Netanyahu government. The killing of an American citizen is a terrible proof point in this senseless war of rising tensions in the region," she said. I want to thank you all for being with us. Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, speaking to us more than two decades after Rachel was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer in Gaza near Rafah. I want to thank Amada Sison, Filipino-American, shot in the leg by Israeli forces a month ago today in Beita, where Ayşenur was also killed. Juliet Majid, PhD student, North Carolina State University, speaking to us from Raleigh. Dear friend of Ayşenur Aygi at the University of Washington, where they both graduated. Coming up, we look at the raids in Jenin. We'll speak with the Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti. Stay with us. By Samira Karubi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We return now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli soldiers stormed the city of Tul Karem just after midnight today, in new raids that come just days after Israeli forces withdrew from Tul Karem and Jenin. Israeli troops also raided the Balata refugee camp in the northern West Bank earlier today and in Abu Shakdim near Ramallah. All Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces were seen raiding homes. On Friday, Israeli forces temporarily retreated from Jenin, Tul Karem, and other areas in the occupied West Bank after laying siege to the cities for 10 days, killing dozens of Palestinians, including children and elders, and leaving a trail of destruction. Simultaneous raids also took place across Nablus, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Ramallah, in the largest Israeli military occupation in the occupied West Bank in two decades, with hundreds of troops backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets, and drones. During the raids, Israeli soldiers fired live rounds at Palestinian journalists documenting the attacks, injuring at least four of them in the town of Kafr Dan. Footage also surfaced of Israeli forces in an armored tank rolling over the dead body of an 82-year-old Palestinian man in Jenin who was killed Friday by Israeli soldiers and denied medical attention. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers continued their attacks in the West Bank. In Kariut, near Nablus, a 13-year-old Palestinian girl was killed by Israeli gunfire as settlers attacked the village. Bana Laboum was hit by a bullet Friday while she was in her bedroom. Her mother described the Israeli attack ahead of her daughter's burial.
She was in her room along with her sisters. She was afraid, in fear, and suddenly a bullet got in through the window and hit her while she was on her bed. This is what happened. There were scuffles outside with the youth, but we were surprised that a bullet came through the window and on to her.
Over 650 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank since October, nearly 150 of them children, most of them during near daily raids by the Israeli military. That's added on to the more than 40,000 Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza, and that figure is expected to be much higher, as 16,000 of them children. We go now to Ramallah, where we're joined by Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist. Her recent piece for 972 magazine is titled Inside the Brutal Siege of Jenin. Mariam, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what has happened there in Jenin.
Thank you for having me, Amy. So what we have seen in Jenin specifically, but generally in the northern areas of the West Bank, is an escalated attack and an offensive under the title of Operation Summer Camps by the Israeli military. And what we have seen is the Israeli military basically greenlighting the use of lethal force excessively and sporadically, which is why we're hearing news of young children being shot by bullets, as well as journalists being sniped by Israeli snipers. And what the Israeli military did was essentially bring in D9 Caterpillar bulldozers within the city of Jenin, likewise in Tul Kerem within the city, and then moving deeper towards the camp, in where they bulldozed nearly the overwhelming majority of the civilian infrastructure. That includes water pipe, that includes electric wiring, that includes the sewage system. And the Israeli military basically besieged the entire city. Entry and exit was dangerous and risky because you can get shot even as pressed. Medical personnel as well as ambulances were obstructed from moving patients, not simply banning injured persons from the camp throughout the 9-day siege, but patients from Jenin City were unable to reach the only governmental hospital in Jenin that is adjacent to the camp and was basically placed under siege by the Israeli military. So what we saw was an intensification and a brutal offensive. Again, this is an offensive by the Israeli military under the, and I quote, it's a preemptive strike against Palestinian terrorists. But what I have seen on the ground is it was targeting essentially civilians mostly, and there was a very clear attempt to conceal what is happening from media, and that means from global audiences.
Again, you said they call this Operation Summer Camps?
Yes. So the Israeli military has called this Operation Summer Camps. It was officially declared between August 27th or 28th of last month. And the Israeli military claims that they are basically targeting refugee camps. That's why summer camps. But again, what we have seen is they're targeting civilians. And they said the refugee camps because that's primarily where Palestinian combatants are operating from. Again, this is the Israeli military going into these areas and attacking these areas under the statement of this is a preemptive strike against terrorism. But what we have seen is a focus on the civilian infrastructure and near destruction of the refugee camps, which are Area A and under the Oslo Accords outside the jurisdiction of the Israeli military or government.
So can you describe what Jenin was like and the level of destruction left behind? Palestinians in the camp describe being forced out of their homes by gunpoint.
Yes, so Jenin has been under constant attack by the Israeli military for the past 2 years specifically, but generally across time in Palestine. But we have seen an intensification. So every other month, the Israeli military would actually invade Jenin refugee camp and carry out lethal attacks against its community. But this time, what we have seen is the brutality is truly unprecedented. The Israeli military, not just in the camp, but even on the outskirts, went into civilian buildings and at gunpoint forced families out of their homes to places unknown, to a fate unknown. They didn't know where they will sleep, how long they will be away from their houses. And when they returned on Friday to their homes after the Israeli withdrawal, what I saw was complete destruction of their homes and their apartments. The furniture was ruined, mattresses, they had dung on them. There were attack dogs that were put in these homes. The refrigerators would be destroyed. There would be Hebrew graffiti on the walls. And inside the camp, it's truly very difficult to capture it in words. I just saw families cleaning up the rubble, cleaning up the trash left behind by the Israeli military. The walls are full of bullets. It's just rubble all over the ground. It's so difficult to walk. Cars can't move within the camp. And the families, you know, when I would ask them, are you going to rebuild? What are you going to do now? They would respond with, why would we rebuild now if the Israeli army is only going to come for another invasion, as we have seen happen in Tul Kerem last night? Again, after a withdrawal from Tul Kerem refugee camp, the Israeli military just kept going back. So people are frightened. They feel abandoned. They have zero protection. And again, in an impoverished area, to rebuild, which is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to rebuild the infrastructure, it's truly a cost and a toll. And clearly, it is put to cripple Palestinian civil society.
Mariam, can you explain who is the Jenin Brigade? What's their role in Jenin versus the security forces affiliated with the Palestinian Authority?
Right. So in Jenin refugee camp, to what the military, Israeli military dubs as the wasp's nest, we have seen a rise of Palestinian armed youth groups starting within 2021 until today. And these are small battalions. These are youth that grew up in the camp. Many of them have been imprisoned by Israel under administrative detention, meaning no trial, no charge, only torture. And they decided to take up arms, essentially, because they found that across the last decade, any efforts of Palestinians